But yes, Derek Hale and Styles. I know that there's a bit of an age gap, but
I was on that ship too. I was so on that ship too. Don't worry. I was so there.
Welcome to the Coffee Shop AU. I'm Jay, your host, and you are listening to part two of my conversation with Sarah about her journey of discovering her bisexual identity as a young adult who also happens to be Muslim and American. To catch up on our conversation so far, please listen to part one of our conversation, and as always, enjoy.
So first, I'll start a little bit earlier and with high school and just talk a little bit about that before talking about what happened in college. Mm-hmm. And with that, I guess what I would say is like, yeah, I didn't recognize these as crushes at the time. And I think I've told you this before, but because I had this very defined idea of what it would look like if I had a crush on someone of the same gender or who basically wasn't a cis man. And I think a lot of the media that I consumed, it was, you know, still like early 2000s and early 2010s. And so it was like very much girl has crush on best friend type of thing and like hopelessly in love. And that's what it is. And I never felt like that about any of like my quote best friends or people I was really close to. So I was like, oh, I don't feel hopelessly in love with my best mm-hmm. friend. So I must not be queer. I think it was really easy to identify what a crush on a cis man looks like because I had seen that a lot and I'd seen people experience that a lot.
Yes.
But I didn't recognize this like admiration and like, weird attraction as in like magnetism, like being drawn to someone, not like physical attraction. Mm-hmm. Of like, I think this person's super hot type.
Because not everybody experienced that either.
Yeah. And I didn't recognize this. I just want to talk to this person and like get to know them. And I really admire them as a crush. Yeah. I just thought that that was my admiration and me kind of wanting to be like them. And so yeah. I think the constant dilemma that a lot of lesbians I've heard say this joke that they've been like, oh, do I want her? Do I want to be her? I think that that totally is like the question in high school, except it was like, I just want to be this person. There wasn't even a, do I want them? It was like, I just want to be them or kind of like hang out with them. They're just so cool.
Right. You didn't have the space to even like
understand
for that to be a dilemma.
Yeah.
It was just out of the question.
Yeah. Because I didn't know that's what it could look like. And so then when I went to college, I gained so much of a better understanding of queerness because I didn't go to college with any of the people that I went to high school with. I was in a new city and I had the opportunity to explore and to meet a lot of different people. And I think a lot of people were exploring their sexuality in college.
I heard that that's a thing.
It is. And like, I feel like a lot of like cis quote straight women will be like, oh, I've never made out with another girl. I want to do it. It's going to be so much fun. And then they're like, oh, it's so much better than like making out with a guy. And they're like, but I'm totally straight. And I'm like, are we all like,
are you?
But like that is like a rite of passage in like American college. I feel like maybe not, but I feel like it's portrayed as that in like movies and stuff too. But like so many people are exploring it. And I never was like, oh, I want to like make out with someone and just see if it feels right. Because I wasn't exploring my sexuality physically at that time. It was still like kind of coming into like my own, and I didn't even know what dating looked like really at the time when I first started in college. And then I was in college peak Tumblr era, and Tumblr was really where I got my exposure to queerness and queer theory, and things really started to make sense. And then I also realized, like, when people would ask me, like, would you make out with someone who wasn't a cis man, just hypothetically? And I was like, yeah, of course, like, whatever. It's not a big deal. And then they'll, like, be like, okay, and you think you're straight? And I'd be like, oh, you might be onto something.
Good question. Critical thinking skills.
Yeah. And I don't think we talked about this, but when I was like in middle school, I read this book. It's called Born Confused. And it's like the story about this like South Asian girl. I think she's like Indian American, if I remember correctly. And that was my first exposure to a queer character and a trans character in fiction. There are two different characters. One of them is queer, one of them is trans.
Wow.
And it was, I want to say like around sixth grade when I first read this book.
Yeah.
The main character is, I guess, presumed to be straight or doesn't really talk about her sexuality as in a queer perspective from what I remember. But there is a character who's queer and, you know, her girlfriend breaks her heart. Sorry, spoilers if anybody ends up reading this book. But her girlfriend ends up breaking her heart and she says this line that I still remember, which is, I would love her in any other body. And that was like a light bulb moment for me when I read it. And I was like, yeah, that's what love is. And then I never really interrogated that until I was in college. Right. And then I was like, oh, I would love someone in any other body isn't necessarily just I love them unconditionally or whatever. That's kind of part of queerness, or my queerness, is that it's not so much about gender or gender expression. It's about my attraction to them and my connection to them. And that can happen for me regardless of the gender expression of the person.
Yeah.
And so the more I met people who were openly queer or figuring that out, or who were like, hey, and you think you're straight? Like, let me ask you this thing. Oh, you answered it this way? Like, you really, really think you're straight? And then like the more I was like on Tumblr and reading queer theory brought down to a 19-year-old, 20-year-old's level.
Right. That's important too. Yeah.
I was like, oh my God, this all makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And then I was like, oh, I'm gay, but like not gay. I'm queer. I'm bisexual. What does that even mean? And then I was like, oh my God. When the floodgates started opening, it opened all the way, you know? But it just took a while.
Right. Totally. I remember when I was like 4 or 5, my favorite thing to do was drawing, just doodling all the time. And I was still going to church. I was being taken to church every week. And my favorite sermons were about Jesus, stories about Jesus. Because I really, really, really vibed with what he was doing.
Yeah, Jesus was pretty dope.
He was like the anarchist of his time, I feel like.
Yeah.
And so one day I just decided I was going to draw Jesus because I really liked the things that he did in the Bible. And I was really in that phase of like drawing naked people. And I drew Jesus and I was really proud of it. And I showed my mom like, hey, I drew Jesus. And she was like, oh, like, okay, so your version of Jesus has like full on facial hair, long eyelashes, boobs, and also a penis with like a full patch of like pubic hair. And she's like, this is Jesus? And I was like, yeah, it's Jesus. Just like, okay. And she didn't say anything, but I have this like really vivid memory of drawing Jesus with like feminine chest and a penis. And I just thought that's what Jesus looked like for whatever reason. Like, and nobody had told me about trans people or anything. But I just thought about Jesus and love and I'm like, this is Jesus.
Big chest means a big heart. You gotta have a lot of cushion to protect your big heart. So you gotta have big boobs. No,
exactly.
I'm kidding. I feel like that makes sense as a child.
Yeah, to me, it was like the most complete human form. And because he was so encompassing, right? Like he was the embodiment of love. And I guess for whatever reason, to me, that just made the most sense that he would look like that. And so just that line of, I would love her in any other body is, I think if I had read that as a kid, I would have also really understood that to mean like, yeah, that's what love is, because it's not about the body parts.
Yeah.
It's about who the person is inside.
It's true. Yeah. I know like probably someone listening is probably going to be like, oh, it's blasphemous to draw Jesus this way or whatever. But I think that really, truly, especially with this feeling that you're describing, it's so pure, you know, and that's what love is. Like, regardless of what Jesus looked like, it's really about what Jesus stood for. And there's so many different ways people have physically represented Jesus. Like, I think here in the United States, you see Jesus as like a very blonde hair, blue eyed man, even though he was from Bethlehem, which means that he was Arab and probably didn't have blonde hair or blue eyes. And they're across cultures, you see people interpreting Jesus to look more like them. And so you have like Korean Jesus, you have Black Jesus, you have Brown Jesus, you have White Jesus.
We have Korean Jesus? I didn't know this.
I've been to a Korean-American church and I've seen Korean Jesus. So I don't know if you have Korean Jesus in Korea, because I've never been to a church in Korea.
No, he was always a white man when I was growing up. And so was God, like an older version of white man.
Fascinating. Because the two times I've been to a Korean-American church, two different Korean-American churches, I've seen Korean Jesus.
Wow.
Like very pale skin, long, dark hair, dark eyes.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is so interesting.
I feel like people will interpret Jesus kind of in a way that they can connect to, because
yes,
ultimately, it's not about the flesh and the body. It's about the meaning, about his teachings, about being a good person, about taking care of the poor, and about loving your neighbor, you know, and these kinds of things.
And, yeah, and being non-judgmental.
Right. And so, you know, that is love. So I totally agree. And I think there's so many different forms of love besides romantic love. Platonic love is so important and so necessary, and is something that we often diminish in our society, but is really what keeps the world going.
Absolutely. Yes. One of the things that I found super interesting about your time at university or college is that you switched majors.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that played a big part in your being able to actually start to explore your sexuality too, or your queerness rather.
Yes.
So would you mind telling us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I switched majors when I was around 20. Mm. And I hadn't really explored my queerness at that point, because I didn't even realize at that point that I was queer, because I was in such a heteronormative major. Yeah, so I feel like the major itself is not heteronormative, but like the people in it were pretty heteronormative, because it leads to a stable career path. It leads to like some level of respect in larger society. It kind of falls into this trajectory of you graduate, you get this job, it's a stable job, you stick with it for like 20, 30 years, you retire, and like whatever else you do outside of that career trajectory is your own business. But that's kind of how it tends to go for most people.
Yeah.
And so I guess it attracts like a very heteronormative crowd. And it was also at my school a very white major and a very like upper middle class to upper class major. And I come from a working class background, and I am brown, and I was the darkest person in most of my classes when I was in that major. And I'm brown, I'm like South Asian, which means that I had no black classmates, for example, which was wild to me because I grew up in Florida and I went to public school there. So I had a lot of Latine classmates and a lot of black classmates. And I actually ended up having fewer white classmates. And then I come to the school and there were no Latine classmates. There were other Asians, East Asian and Southeast Asian. And then there was me. So there were four of us total who were people of color. And then everybody else was white in my major.
Whoa.
Yeah. And that was like our ethnic breakdown. And so it was such a culture shock. You know, it's a very respectable major. It's very favored by upper middle class white people. And that's not like a knock at it or saying like it's a bad thing or anything like that. But just saying that like it did attract a certain type of crowd. And I didn't fit in with that crowd.
Sure.
And then I switched my major and I went into the arts. And I ended up double majoring in two different art majors. And that's when I met people who were exploring themselves in so many different ways, not just their sexuality and not just their gender, but just like creatively exploring themselves. And I feel like I was then able to creatively explore myself, my identity, who I was. And the major was like a lot more diverse, both of them. Like I wasn't the only one of four Asian kids. I wasn't even one of four POC. You know, there were more people of color, and it was like a wider variety of people of color. And, you know, and by the time I switched my major, everybody else at my previous major who was Asian had also left that major. So I was like the last Asian standing. I was like the last one there. And then I was like gone. And I was like from the class that I started with. And so then I was like, oh, my God. Okay.
Did they all switch over to some sort of art major as well? Or
most of them did. Only one of them didn't.
Okay. Wow. Okay.
One of them went into engineering, and then the rest of us were into different art majors.
Right.
But even the engineering school was more diverse.
Wow.
Anyway, okay. Yes, I was in this art major or more creative major, and people were exploring themselves, they were exploring their identities. People were more open to dialogues in general, it felt like, not just about sexuality, but about identity, about culture, about politics. Mm. Like, we didn't agree, but there were like people who were willing to have these conversations. Yeah. And I think like there was a little less room for nuance. I feel like when you're younger, or at least for me and my experience, like when I was younger and when I was around that age, like there was some nuance, but not to the extent that I have now. So some people would take like hardline approaches. I think I had some hardline approaches to my politics and perspective, but there were still conversations happening. So there was like this freedom creatively and in the way that you're able to think, the way that you're able to communicate, the way that you're able to express yourself, that naturally allowed itself for the space to explore my gender and sexuality. And I still identify as cisgender, but it's something that I have been able to think about. You know, it's not like my gender was never a question to me. It's like, it was something that I have been able to like challenge consistently and think about consistently. Mm. And that was kind of where I was really able to start questioning and exploring and understanding. Mm. And I feel like I met a lot more queer people once I switched majors. Mm-hmm. And seeing the different ways of queerness, or like how different everybody who identified as queer was, it made me realize that, yeah, I didn't fall into this like mold that I thought queerness looked like when I was in high school, because that mold didn't really exist. Mm. That was like just what was presented to me, but that wasn't true. And then when I got to see everybody in their different queernesses, I guess if you want to call it that, I was like, oh, I kind of fit in somewhere here. Like, I can kind of slot myself in somewhere on this little spectrum. And I was like, light bulb. It took a while. And again, I give huge...
That and Tumblr.
Yeah, I give huge credit to Tumblr. But also all of those people were on Tumblr. And so I was like, this is where you're getting your information from. So shout out Tumblr, early 2010s.
Shout out to Tumblr. Yeah. You said that you met somebody at a queer event or a queer space, and they approached you and they said they knew you were on Tumblr because they follow you on Tumblr.
Not quite. So one of my classmates and I, we were talking about queerness, and that I was like, I thought I was coming out to them, and I was like, yeah, you know, I kind of maybe. And then they were like, yeah, I follow you on Tumblr, I know you're bi. And I was like, oh, I forgot.
Amazing.
And I was like, oh, amazing. Yeah, I forgot you follow, because like I didn't follow all my classmates on Tumblr, and not all of them followed me, and so I knew which Tumblr accounts to follow through them, but you know, only a few of us followed each other. And so when they were like, oh yeah, I follow you on Tumblr, I was like, oh shit, I forgot, you know? It wasn't like something I kept track of.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh.
You know, the most amazing thing about that is that every one of your classmates had a Tumblr page. I thought that was like the only people that I know of who have Tumblr pages still. Because I discovered Tumblr like in my like maybe mid-20s. Through the world of fan fiction and just individual writers who had their own Tumblr pages, and I would go over and they would just have like pictures of doors. That's all they had on Tumblr. And of course it was known for its porn content still back then. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure about now, but
no, it's not anymore.
Yeah, I heard that they were doing something about that. But I remember like nice, cool gifs and stuff in fandoms. I was really into Teen Wolf at a certain point.
Me too.
Really? Teen Wolf was pretty cool. The series creator is a gay man, I think.
I didn't know that. Interesting.
Yeah, saw a little like talk on YouTube. But yes, Derek Hale and Styles. I know that there's a bit of an age gap. But
I was on that ship too. I was so on that ship too. Don't worry. I was so there. usually the age gap bothers me. And then I was like, but one of them is like a werewolf. And I feel like that kind of requires a level of like suspension of disbelief already. So I'm like, whatever, we're just going to pretend like this guy stopped aging at 22.
Yes, it's set in a fantasy world. And also, you know, what gave me a little bit of a comfort level with that was, and I'm not endorsing this in real life at all, but Styles, I feel like there was a lot of like real life interactions that were feeding into that ship, and I have no idea if I'm going to put this into the episode or not, but the actor who plays Styles Stilinski, he's the one in a lot of interviews, the way he reacts to the actor who plays
Derek,
it's just so like a puppy love sort of like, oh my gosh, like this person's amazing. And I feel like that bleeds over into their interactions like on the show. There was a huge fandom around those two just because of in interviews and stuff, like you would just see that interaction between the actors. And even on the show, Styles was the one who was a bit more, he seemed a bit more affected by Derek. And there was that whole fandom interpretation of like, he's just super turned on by this older guy who wears cool leather jackets, and he's also a werewolf, and like, of course, if you're a high schooler and a werewolf looking like that shows up, you know, you can have that reaction. Yeah. And it's like, that's okay.
Exactly.
That's okay.
I think if I were to like go back now and discover Teen Wolf for the first time, I may not ship it because of that age gap, and like now I'm much more aware. Mm. But at that time, I was so close to that age that for me, I didn't see it as a big gap.
Yeah.
But also, like, that dynamic between them was so fun on screen, because Styles is kind of like the only human one. He's like, I'm bumbling around trying to figure out this whole werewolf thing with my best friend.
That's
here's
so
true. This kind of intimidating werewolf who's like taking my best friend under his wing, but also could be dangerous. And also, I don't really trust him, but also, he's kind of cool. And it's, you know, yeah, both the actors are pretty hot, pretty conventionally attractive. And so that also helped. But I think that it was just such a fun dynamic of like grumpy werewolf, yeah, like bumbling, but very sunny human.
Oh, yeah. Grumpy werewolf and like a big Labrador.
Yeah.
The way you just put it, to me, sounded a lot like a queer allegory of like a baby gay coming into the queer scene. And there are all these werewolves who are cool. They know what they're about and they're sort of demonized by society or hunted. But you're like fascinated and you're kind of maybe attracted. And yeah, your best friend is also a werewolf. So he can safely be like no homo, but he's not really willing to be no homo.
Right. Yeah.
Hey, we're like really getting into this. I never really read a lot of fan fiction in that fandom because I just couldn't connect to the writing. Mm-hmm. But I love the GIFs and the fan videos people would make. It was just so funny and so relatable.
Yeah.
Like you, I don't know if I would do it now. It's about a bunch of teenagers. But there were some really genuinely lovely moments in that show. I still remember when the main character,
Scott, I think.
Scott, yeah. When he met his first girlfriend and he was like having a freak out after turning into a werewolf and his heart rate was going up during class.
Oh, yeah.
And she just like reaches out and holds his hand and his heart rate slows down. And for me, that scene really stuck with me. That was a beautiful moment in that show about a bunch of teenage werewolves.
Yeah, I really liked that show. I remember it fondly. I have not rewatched it. I refuse to like ruin it for myself because I know it was campy, but I liked that about it at the time. Mm. And I don't want to go back to it and be like, oh, this was problematic or oh, this was too campy or whatever. I'm just like, I will leave it in the time capsule that is. But also, yeah, the fandom took a life of its own. Mm-hmm. Again, I didn't read any of the Teen Wolf fanfic like you, but I saw a lot of fan art, a lot of GIFs, a lot of like funny text posts too. And I think that definitely is something that I look back fondly on. I have some of my favorite ships, and that's one of the ships that I really enjoyed in college.
Aww.
Another ship that I really got into that got me into like fandom and reading some level of fanfic, even though I wasn't really into fanfic when I was in college. But I liked the Draco and Harry pairing shipping. And I think like part of that was like the fan art was so good. But also I had really enjoyed Harry Potter as a child. And then J.K. Rowling came out as like being very transphobic. And so I felt like the only Harry Potter related content that I could enjoy was one that wasn't profiting her.
The fan created work.
Yeah. And so it was always the fan created work. And so Derry was a great one because I love an enemies to lovers trope. And then I got into the Draenioni, I guess is what it's called, the Draco Hermione fan art too, started popping up on my feed on Tumblr. And I was like, oh, I really like this because they also like race bent all the characters too.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
And so it was like this really interesting and cool and like fun and more like relatable artwork, and it had just taken a life of its own, and I just really enjoyed that. Another big ship that I got into thanks to Tumblr was from Avatar the Last Airbender, and both the like Zuko Sokka and the Zuko Katara ships. Again, enemies to lovers, or like kind of serious grumpy one and kind of goofy fun one.
Yeah.
Very fun dynamics.
I get that. Yeah. Now I'm just going through all my favorite ships and finding the friends to... No, not friends to enemies. Enemies to lovers pattern too. Oh, interesting. In my favorite ships, though, people are always fighting. Like, physically, they're in fights together. Like, battles. And, like, gunfights. And I don't know what that's about. But, yeah, I really like that, too. I wonder what it is. Maybe it gives us hope that we're not doomed to dislike the people that we dislike now forever. We can actually grow to love them at some point.
Yeah, there has to be some sort of psychological undercurrent. I should ask a therapist, but I also don't want to be psychoanalyzed that deeply. Maybe not yet.
About your fan fiction taste.
Yeah.
One of the things that really stood out in our last conversation when we talked about your time in college was how you described how in creative spaces, whether it's like an art major or I guess like any kind of artistically oriented spaces, there are people who are more willing to explore queerness or at least be non-judgmental than in certain other disciplines or fields of studies or work.
Yeah.
We agreed on why that was.
Yeah.
We have theories.
We do. Yeah. I think one of the theories I have is because the arts force you to think outside of the box, and queerness forces you to think outside of the box, and they are both complementary to each other. Like, if you're willing to think outside of the box about your gender, your sexuality, you can also think outside of the box creatively, like about the world around you in general. And I think the ability to question the world around you or to analyze it and try to look at it from different perspectives gives you the skill to be able to analyze and question yourself, and vice versa. When you're able to question and analyze yourself, you're able to like look at the world around you and think a bit deeper about it, peel back those layers, as we were saying. I think that these are just very complementary skills, and so my theory is that they benefit each other. And I think that also because creative industries are often out of the societal norm, you know, we were talking about that you go to school, you graduate, you get this job, you stick with it for 20 to 30 years, and then you retire, whatever. In creative industries, you don't always have that stability a lot of times. So it kind of attracts a few different types of people, but one of the types of people it attracts is people who are really interested in that artistic endeavor. Another type of person that attracts is people who like changing things up and who may not like that level of stability, or it might feel intimidating for them. And I think in both of those scenarios, a lot of queer people can identify with that, where they don't want to like either live what I call like a checklist life, where they grow up, get married, have 2.5 children, maybe a dog or a cat, buy a house, blah, blah, blah. They're like, my life is going to have to look different from that because of my queerness, or maybe it won't, but I would have to figure out a way to make that happen because of my queerness and it's not being fully accepted in a lot of different societies. So that's like the stability route, and the other route of like, just like the love of the art and like really wanting to like explore the art. I think like it goes back to the self-exploration, right? And I think so many queer people can identify with that because they've had to explore themselves and had to think creatively and had to think out of the box of what their life looks like or who they are. And that sort of career or field of study can feel really attractive when you're already in that mindset.
Yes. In that kind of having to imagine what doesn't exist yet.
Exactly.
And that requires a lot of imagination, a lot of what ifs. and that ties in so closely with any other type of creative endeavor. And I was speaking with someone who was, I think maybe was interested in me in a romantic / sexual sense. And this person was not super certain about where they stood on in terms of labels. They were acknowledging that they are not 100% straight, but also not really willing to claim that title of queer. Those were their words. And then I said, at this stage in my life, I don't know if I can get really involved on that level with somebody who doesn't identify as being part of the queer community. And they asked me why, which is a valid question. And I couldn't really answer the question in the moment. And I gave them some form of answer. But then later on, I was thinking about it on my own. And in a different conversation with my trans friends, I said to them, you know, someone asked me this question, and I think my true answer is that if you're not part of this community, then that to me signals that they're not really in a space right now in their life where they feel the need to imagine a different reality. The reason I feel so comfortable and so much growth in the queer communities that I am part of now is because I know that we're collectively all putting our effort into imagining a different reality where we can thrive, where we can exist with less fear and more safety and with more joy. And I feel like maybe on different levels, but we're all part of that effort actively. And that to me is very important. That gives me a sense of safety, gives me a sense of commitment, and yeah, just reality, you know, the reality we're working towards together. And that's the significant difference for me. And I was able to just come to that conclusion because somebody asked me that question. But that's something that I hadn't thought about before. And I think it relates to your experience in the more art-leaning major that you studied and the kinds of people that you found also drawn to those studies.
I do want to go back and say, like, there was one other group of people who I interacted with who I feel like have that overlap of queer and in the arts major. I think the third one is like the people who are just kind of the misfits. We find ourselves in the art majors, and then we also find ourselves to be queer. I think that's kind of, you don't fit in for some reason, and then you find your place and you're like, oh, this makes sense. And that's like that other group of people who I think are in the arts and also queer. And that's not to say that these are the only three groups, but
of course not.
These are just some of them that I have found. And then to get back to what you were just saying, I think that that's a really interesting question that was posed to you. I don't know how I would answer that. If it were posed to me, maybe I would feel comfortable, maybe I wouldn't. But I think that this point that you bring up of collectively imagining a future for ourselves together. I think that's really important. And I think whether or not someone identifies with the label of queer, queerness is an exercise in imagination, because you have to imagine a world in which queer people thrive. And that's not an original thought. That's something I get from like a lot of other queer people who've said that. I think Alok Vaid Menon is someone who said that. Many other people have said something to this effect.
Can I say, interject? Just really quickly, I saw an interview with Alok pretty recently where the interviewer was like, so what is this reality that you're imagining for queer people such as yourself? And they said, we're already living in it. We are creating it by existing as ourselves. And, you know, like everything they say all the time, every word that comes out of their mouth is always like earth shattering for me. But that is also important to remember, I think. I really agree with that. And so they're obviously not the representative of the queer community,
of course.
But it takes all sorts of people like them who are really, I feel like, at the forefront of creating these changes. And then there are some people like the rest of us who are all finding, we all have to find our own ways, I think. But it's also a collective effort at the same time. So that's why I feel like it's important for, like you said, there are like different queer people echoing similar sentiments and messages. And it's because we all each have lived experiences that brings us to that conclusion, right? That there isn't enough space in this world for us to exist as ourselves. And so we need to actively create those spaces.
Yeah. It reminds me of this quote, I believe, by James Baldwin, who said that the place in which I belong will not exist until I create it. Uh-huh. And I have my laptop open, so let me double check that quote. I think that this is something that people who are marginalized in society, whether it's because you're Black or whether it's because you're brown or whether it's because you're queer or whether it's because of your intersecting identities or whether it's because you're, you know,
religion,
all of these things, like religion. So you can be queer and trans and
Muslim
and or Sikh or whatnot, and you know, all of these different intersecting identities, and you have all these layers of marginalization. And all that is to say that so many of us struggle to find this place which we belong, because we live in this very patriarchal, cishet, Eurocentric society that props up a certain kind of ideal and wants us to fit that. And I feel like majority of the people globally do not fit that.
Yeah.
Yet we're all held to this standard.
Yeah.
And, you know, we all have to imagine a place in which we can exist and thrive. And I think queerness is just one of those identities that force us to imagine that.
Out of necessity,
yeah. We don't have that luxury to kind of be like, in all these other ways, I fit in with the mainstream or I fit in with this ideal.
Yeah.
And so I can just put my blinders on and not have to worry about it.
You know, I read or heard somewhere, if you can afford to walk away from a conversation when it starts to get uncomfortable for you, that's privilege. I really, you know, that's a very accurate way of putting it, I think. The reason I see this as such a collective thing and a very individual thing at the same time is because once you start to peel back those layers and you see that we really need to create new realities for ourselves, and you begin to understand intersectionality and the certain privileges that you have others don't and that others do that you don't, it becomes clear to you that it's about you and it's about all these other people who are standing at different points in these intersectionalities. So in order to create a reality for you where you can be safe and you can thrive, we need to come up with a solution where other people who come from different, other people who are different from you can also be safe and be whole and thrive together. So I think it's really wonderful that once you start to peel back those layers, like you see this interconnectivity. Like the need for interdependence and the need to consider other people's reality, not just your own, because it's all relational. Like I am really learning about relationships and listening, the need to listen, because I'm queer and because we're like all trying to paint outside the box or the lines or whatever. And we realize that we're not alone. We felt alone in the box, but once you step out, it's like, oh, look at all these other people. Like, what can we create together?
Yeah, I did find the quote. The quote is by James Baldwin, and the quote is, "The place in which I'll fit will not exist until I make it."
He said a lot of cool things.
Yeah.
Cool truths.
James Baldwin is such an amazing thinker and writer and speaker.
Speaker too,
Was, I guess I shouldn't say is, but
I mean, lives on, you know, in this age of social media.
Lives on, true. But yeah, and I think that, like you were saying, our struggles are so interconnected. And for me, growing up in the United States, I've learned that through a Black feminist lens, because that's how I've grown up and learned about intersectionality. But I think that when you just see and understand that simple truth, no matter how you get to it, whether it's through your queerness, whether it's through different marginalizations, and you accept it, because I think there are a lot of people who get to that truth and then they reject it. But I think when you get to that and understanding that our struggles are way more interconnected than even we like can see on our day-to-day lives, then we can really start to like imagine a different world. You and I, we live in two different countries, but so many of the things that we have in common as far as like struggles that we've encountered overlap.
Yeah. And the joys that we've experienced overlap too.
Exactly. And so I don't know the exact words that I'm trying to think of, so I'm not going to say this very eloquently, but basically, like, knowing that we face similar struggles in two different countries that are not that close to each other physically, and knowing that we've experienced similar joys as well means that we can together build a world that we can experience more joy and ideally less struggle. And that just can't be for us, but it has to be for everyone.
Right. It's never just about you or just about me. It just isn't.
Right.
It's about everyone.
And I think queerness can teach us that. Teach us how interconnected our struggles are. I mean, and there are different ways of approaching intersectionality. Like I said, I'm not going to say this very eloquently, but there are different ways of coming into intersectionality. But I think if you see that, see how interconnected our struggles are, acknowledge it and not reject it, then you can start to do that work, is I think what I'm trying to say, is you can start to say, hey, let's try this. Let's take this approach and see if that works, or let's try this other thing, but let's start the work. Or, you know, there are a lot of people who are doing the work. Let me get involved in this way.
Yeah. And I think my favorite thing about being part of the queer communities, tees, there are multiple, is that most of the time when somebody says, hey, shall we try this? So many people just jump and they're like, yes. Like, so many people are willing to do the work. Rather than, oh, maybe later, maybe when the time is better, because we all feel the necessity, like, on a day-to-day basis for things to change. I just really like that about the queer communities I've encountered.
Yeah.
And I agree. Yeah, it's like, you know, it doesn't have to be through being queer, like getting involved in creating a new, different reality for more people to be happier in. But for me, at least, you know, being my ethnic identity, living in a white society when I was living in the UK, just made me feel super isolated. But for some reason, learning about my queer identity and becoming part of the community, I've just been able to meet more people with similar experiences to mine, but from just different backgrounds. So, you know, not just the racism, not just being East Asian. That's just the way that I experienced it. And to me, like, being queer and being innovative are like synonyms. I guess I'm just trying to really drive that point home.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, you need to be told about this.
I think that overlap between creativity and queerness is pretty significant. And, you know, that Venn diagram, I think we've said it before, isn't a circle, but it's